Run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run. Don't give the farmer his fun, fun, fun. He'll get by without his rabbit pie. So run, rabbit, run, rabbit, run, run, run.
Did you like that? I thought I'd switch the intro to something topical this week. The most topical thing happening has been the Democrat legislators in Wisconsin and Indiana fleeing out of state so that their legislatures can't curtail the power of the public sector unions who feed them with money contributed by their members, public sector workers, out of their salaries, which, of course, are paid by you and me through our taxes. I went looking for some piece of music titled Flight of the Tax Eaters, but all I could find was Flight of the Bumblebee. And Flight of the Valkyries. Which, please don't email in to tell me, is actually Ride of the Valkyries, Valkyrienritt, but is misnamed all over the web. Oh, and Flight of the Intruder, but that was a movie. Or, for those of you with long TV memories, there was the theme music of
The Fugitive.
None of them was really what I was looking for, though, so I figured Flanagan and Allen filled the bill. And anyway, they brought back misty recollections of my earliest childhood. Okay, this is, of course, Radio Derb, and this is your nostalgically genial host, John Derbyshire, with all the week's news. First, let's cover those fugitive legislators. Assuming they haven't finally tracked down the one-armed man by the time we go to podcast. This entire imbroglio in Wisconsin, and now in Indiana, illustrates a thing I've been harping on for years. The folly of permitting public sector employees to unionize. Here I was in February 2003. 8 years ago. Long quote. Why do public sector workers need unions? The purpose of unions is to protect employees against unscrupulous bosses who might seek to maximize profits by taking advantage of those who work for them. In the public sector, however, there are no profits to be maximized, no shareholders to appease. The work that is being done in the public interest, against which, as Calvin Coolidge quite correctly declared, there is no right to strike. So, what do government workers need unions for? If public sector workers don't like their pay and conditions, they can appeal to the tax-paying public, who are their ultimate employers. If that doesn't work, they can go get jobs in the private sector and take their chances with capitalism, like free citizens of a free nation. Please don't write and whine to me. I'm a public servant. I've worked my buns off for 30 years at a demanding and essential job for an unimpressive salary. Why are you being mean to me? I'm not being mean to you. I like you. Thank you for your work, for your service to my country. I sincerely thank you. I just don't see why you need a union. End of long quote. To this day, 8 years later, I still haven't heard a reasonable explanation of why public sector workers need unions. I understand the political dynamics, of course. Public sector unions stuff Benjamins into the pockets of corrupt Poles. The Poles pass laws to tax citizens and businesses. Tax revenue flows in. Poles use it to hire more government workers, paying their salaries and benefits out of those taxes. A slice of these taxpayer-funded salaries is creamed off by the unions, who now, have more Benjamins to stuff into the Poll's pockets. Lather, rinse, repeat. It's the perfect racket. I just don't understand how we let it happen. We're stuck with these public sector unions, though, unfortunately, and they've taken over one of our big political parties, so it's not likely we'll get rid of them. The proverbial toothpaste is out of the proverbial tube. The political appeal we can make, and that Governor Walker is making, is that benefits for public sector workers can't be as extravagantly out of line with the private sector as, in many states and cities, they have become. Nor should we allow the left to get away with the sleight of hand they're pulling, pretending that they're standing up for union rights. Nobody, well, hardly anybody, has any argument with union rights. The issue here is public sector unions. They are not at all in the same relation to the economy as private sector unions. In fact, by distorting state revenues with their gold-plated benefit packages, public sector unions are forcing tax increases on the rest of us, making life more difficult for people in private sector unions. Public sector unions aren't in comradely solidarity with private sector unions. The two groups are actually antagonistic. If public workers are sucking all the wealth from a state, businesses won't locate there, and there will be no private sector jobs. How is that good for private sector unions? It's hard to think of anything that would give so much innocent pleasure to so many people in the civilized portion of the world than a YouTube video of Muammar Gaddafi being strung up from a lamppost in Tripoli after first being riddled with bullets. No, make that before being riddled with bullets. Alas, it's not very likely that this satisfaction will be vouchsafed to us. Presumably, Gaddafi has a private jet, fueled up and ready to take him off to wherever democracy-hating tyrants, stripped of their power, flee to nowadays. Saudi Arabia, Iran, Illinois, wherever. Some of my colleagues are consoling themselves with the thought that even though we may not get to see Colonel Looney Tunes dancing on the end of a rope, what comes after him will surely be better. I don't believe this for a minute. Libya has no tradition of rational government, and it's not a thing you can buy for $16.95 at Walmart. It takes 9 months to have a baby. You can't hurry the process. Likewise, it takes a millennium or so of political progress to get to rational government, and the Arabs have barely started. Drastic interventions can sometimes kickstart the process, to be sure. Having two of their cities nuked did it for Japan. Absent interventions on that scale, though, we just have to wait out the few centuries it's going to take the Arabs to advance from barbarism to civilization. The ideal would be to fence them off in the meantime and let them get on with it. Unfortunately, they have all that oil, so we have to pretend that they are real countries with real governments and smile through clenched teeth at their crazy dictators, fat potentates, and strutting military men who haven't won a war since the 12th century. Well, we don't all have to. We have diplomats to do most of the dirty work for us, and a president to bow and grovel to the head bagman in charge. Even in this depressing context, though, Gaddafi was a nasty piece of work, and while whatever follows him will be no better, and quite possibly worse, we should rejoice in his humiliation. This is the guy who gave the order to blow up Panam 103 over Scotland 23 years ago, killing 270 people, 41 of them college students from my home state here, New York. Everybody knows this. As they say in Ireland, even the dogs in the street know it. Certainly the national leaders of the West have all known it pretty much since it happened. Once we knew it, we would have been entirely justified in obliterating Libya's three or four significant cities, reducing the population to the nomadic beggary of their grandfathers, and occupying the Libyan oil fields. That would have put an end to terrorism against the West for 100 years. Of course, no Western government has the stones to behave like that, so the repulsive Gaddafi was allowed to go on for another 20 years, making incomprehensible speeches, roasting his political enemies over slow fires, and being serviced by his harem of blonde East European bunnies. Now the game's up for Gaddafi. Let's hope that wherever the bastard ends up, his enemies find him and subject him to a death at least as slow and terrible as that he delivered to the passengers and crew of Pan Am Flight 103. Then wrap his corpse in a pigskin and leave it on a garbage dump somewhere. Sorry, was that too eliminationist for you? Wake up. This is a guy who's needed eliminating for the past 5 US presidencies. It can't happen too soon. If our federal government practiced sane policies, an important component of our attitude to barbarous regions would be to keep their people firmly excluded from the USA. This could easily be done via stringent immigration policies, good border security, and vigilance at our ports of entry. That would be if we practiced sane policies. Our actual policies are insane. Consider, for example, the granting of visas to Saudis. In the brief spell of common sense that followed the 9/11 attacks, in which, let it be remembered, 15 of the 19 hijackers were Saudi nationals, in that brief spell, the number of Saudis entering the USA to study at our colleges fell from 4,000 a year to just 1,000 in the year 2005. That was very distressing to George W. Bush, constantly plagued as he was by the thought that there are far too many Americans in America. He accordingly made a deal with the Saudis, as a result of which the numbers of visas granted rapidly increased. More than 10,000 Saudi students came here in 2006. The goal, said the Saudi ambassador, was to get 20,000 a year coming in. What a great idea! What could possibly go wrong? Fast forward to Thursday of this week. On that day, the US Justice Department issued a press release, title, quote, Texas resident arrested on charge of attempted use of weapon of mass destruction. Texas resident, eh? Who was this good old boy, this Texas resident, this bow-legged cowboy with jingling spurs, a 10-gallon hat and a wad of tobacco in his cheek? Let the Justice Department tell us. Quote, Khalid Ali al-Dawsari, age 20, a citizen of Saudi Arabia and resident of Lubbock, Texas, was arrested late yesterday by FBI agents in Texas on a federal charge of attempted use of a weapon of mass destruction in connection with his alleged purchase of chemicals and equipment necessary to make an improvised explosive device, and his research of potential U.S. targets. End quote. Reading down that Justice Department press release, we learn that among the targets on Mr. al-Dawsari's list was the Dallas residence of former President George W. Bush. Come now, Mr. al-Dawsari, where's your sense of gratitude? I couldn't care less if the inhabitants of Libya, Egypt, Yemen, and all the other Middle Eastern rat holes kill, cook, and eat each other. But I was very distressed to read about the earthquake in New Zealand. The city of Christchurch in the southern island of New Zealand suffered particularly badly, with over 100 people killed, including about 20 in the city's cathedral, which is Anglican, of course. My connection to Christchurch is indirect. My father spent the happiest years of his young adulthood there, back in the late 1920s, and he always spoke very nostalgically of the place. My half-brother was born there, to a mother named of Goddard, and I know there are many Goddards in the neighbourhood still. I hope they're all safe. I hope the good people of Christchurch will rebuild their city, and I'm sure they will. As Radio Derb pointed out last week, one unfortunate side effect of the troubles in the Arab world has been a flood of refugees heading across the Mediterranean for Europe. The Europeans, of course, are being complete pussies about the whole business. Quote from the BBC News website. Italy, Spain, France, Cyprus, Malta and Greece presented joint proposals at a meeting of EU interior ministers in Brussels on Thursday. The six Mediterranean countries demand a programme for relocation, that is, spreading asylum seekers around Europe if they arrive in large numbers. End quote. That qualifies as multicultural idiocy of the week. But what is the meaning of large numbers in that last sentence? Further quote from the Beeb, quote, at least 1 million migrants, many of them from sub-Saharan Africa, are believed to be in Libya, hoping to reach Europe. End quote. Just what Europe needs, another 1 million sub-Saharan Africans. Subsistence farmers from Chad, goat herds from the Sudan, camel drivers from Mali. These are just the people likely to perk up Europe's 20% unemployment economies. And after that initial 1 million, what then? Another 1 million, and another, and another. Sub-Saharan Africa has a population of over 800 million, with a growth rate of 2.3% annually, which is to say close to 20 million a year. The average woman in Niger has 7.2 children in her lifetime. Burundi, 6.8. The Congo, 6.7. Mali, 6.5. You get the idea. By comparison, the rate for Mexico is 2.3. With Libya a major transit point for people from sub-Saharan Africa trying to get to Europe, Gaddafi, for all his grotesque faults, has, when suitably bribed, of course, been an ally to the Europeans in helping to stem the tide. With Gaddafi gone, things will get worse. Way worse. All the countries along the North African shore, Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, they all have plunging birth rates and dysfunctional governments. They can't stop the tide of desperate people moving up from the south. I read recently an account by a traveller in the interior of Algeria who'd known the country well for 30 years. He said that villages down there that had once been entirely Arab were now entirely sub-Saharan African. These are the great demographic tides roiling the old world. The Europeans need a firm and firmly ethnocentric policy for coping with them, if they're not to become minorities in their own countries. Kumbaya isn't going to cut it. As a long-time enemy of government space programs in general, and manned space programs in particular, I'm happy to report the approaching end of the stupid and wasteful space shuttle program. The USA has three space shuttles, Discovery, Endeavour, and Atlantis. Thursday afternoon this week, Discovery was launched into orbit on an 11-day mission to deliver stuff to the International Space Station, whose purpose is to give the shuttle something to do. Two more flights will follow, Endeavour in April and Atlantis in June. After that, praise the Lord, the US government will be out of the manned spaceflight business, which it never ought to have been in the first place. The main idea for the future is that we'll rely on the Russians to get us into orbit for a few years, and then commercial firms will take up the slack, with some pump priming from federal funds to help them. It sounds nice, and I have no objection to private firms putting Americans into space, if they can make a profit from doing so. I still don't see why federal funds are necessary, since the man-in-space business will be entirely recreational for the foreseeable future, with no practical applications and no scientific returns that couldn't be got at a hundredth the cost with automated systems. Still, I wish Discovery well on this anti-penultimate shuttle mission, and I hope she gets back safely to Earth. A fatality rate of 2 crews lost in, I think it's 127 flights, is bad enough. Nearly 1.6%. Please let it not get any worse. And let's hope that by the end of this year, Discovery, Endeavour and Atlantis will be what they always should have been. Theme park attractions. The national debt seems like a kind of an abstract thing to most of us, but in fact it has a direct impact on our taxes. Servicing the national debt, that is, paying interest on the treasury bonds held by people like, oh, say, the Chinese Communist Party, is a big national expense, which comes out of our taxes. It's big, and it's soon going to get a whole lot bigger. Quote from the Washington Post, February 17th, quote, interest payments on the national debt will quadruple in the next decade, and every man, woman, and child in the United States will be paying more than $2,500 a year to cover for the nation's past profligacy, according to figures in President Obama's new budget plan. That strikes me as optimistic. Obama's budget plan rests on wildly unrealistic forecasts of economic growth. Forget about the president's stupid happy talk. What is most likely to happen in the near future is that the present feeble recovery will stall, and we shall slip into another recession, with the deficit still unsustainably huge. There will then be no prospect of stimulus or bailouts. The US government will perforce respond to that next recession, not by increasing spending, but by cutting it. That's the right thing to do for long-term improvement, but in the short term, with the debt overhang already humongous, it will leave the economy dead in the water. Even the feeble, unconvincing recovery we've gotten as a result of the last 2 years' spend-o-rama will not be possible. In that situation, investor confidence will at last collapse. The markets will dump our sovereign debt, and the only way, absolutely the only way, for the feds to meet their domestic obligations will be by massive and sustained inflation. Your savings will become worthless. A gallon of gasoline will cost $500, and your city police and fire services will be laid off. Bottom line, get in lots of canned food, bottled water, and ammo. It's going to be very bad. I don't see any way out of this. This is serious. I'm not kidding. We have sown the wind. Now we get to reap the whirlwind. And stop blaming people. This group, that group, politicians, businessmen. We've done this to ourselves. Stupidity, said the great Robert A. Heinlein, stupidity is the only universal capital crime. I sincerely hope the punishment our country is in for will not be capital. But make no mistake, whatever it is, we have it coming. And here, riding her bicycle up the driveway, here comes Miss Eleni. Item: Steve Saylor raises the very interesting question of Tony Rezko, Illinois real estate developer and friend and backer and real estate advisor to Barack Obama in his Illinois days. You may recall that Rezko was convicted back in June 2008 on 16 counts of fraud, corruption and money laundering. So, what was his sentence? Strangely, very strangely, there hasn't been one. Close to 3 years after conviction, Rezko still awaits sentencing. 3 years. Steve has learned that Rezko is serving his time, whatever it turns out to be, at a secret location, a county jail in Wisconsin. We don't even know which county. What a strange business. Item: at least Tony Rezko got a trial. Here are two perps, Samuel Lee Conway and Jeremy Pickney. They are two of the three guys who murdered five people in Piercy, Arkansas, back in November 2009. That's 15 months ago. The third perp died in a shootout with police trying to arrest the three. Conway and Pickney were formally charged with the five murders on March 5th last year. The latest news we have is that Conway will go to trial in April, Pickney in June. That'll be 13 months and 15 months after they were charged. Conway may, in fact, never go to trial. His attorney is pressing for an insanity ruling. If he gets it, Conway, who, by the way, seems to be a serial killer, last September he was indicted in another unrelated murder case, Conway will hang out at a state mental health facility until either he escapes or some shrink declares him cured. Even if not, what takes so long with these cases? And this is a high-profile one, since Conway and Pickney are white, and the five people they murdered were all black. Oh, no, wait a minute. That's not right. Conway and Pickney are straight, and the five people they murdered were all gay. That's why it's high-profile. No, wait, that's still wrong. Here we are. Conway and Pickney are black, and the five people they murdered were all white. That's it. That's why it's so high profile. That's why it's been all over the news this past few months. So, thank goodness for the fearless reporters of our mainstream media, keeping our attention fixed on Tony Rezko, the Piercy massacre, and all the other deplorable things happening in our country. Thanks, guys. Item: in our December 3rd broadcast, we reported on a group of Columbia University students who'd managed to get a flag-raising ceremony approved. Not the Viet Cong flag, or the Cuban flag, or the Palestinian flag either. This was Old Glory, being raised in a formal ceremony every Monday morning at 7 o'clock at the southwest corner of Low Library. In the most liberal college, in the most liberal city, in the Republic's most liberal state, this is little short of amazing. Well, one step forward, two steps back at Columbia. Last week, former U.S. Army Staff Sergeant Anthony Maschek showed up at Columbia to participate in a campus meeting about reinstating ROTC at the school. Sergeant Anthony Maschek came in his wheelchair. He's partially disabled after taking multiple wounds and losing part of a leg during a firefight in Iraq 3 years ago. As he tried to speak, students opposed to ROTC heckled and jeered him and called him a racist. Let's just file this one away in the civility folder, shall we? Finally, our First Lady has put the breastfeeding of infants in the news. She favours it. Sarah Palin, who also favours it, nonetheless mocked Mrs. Obama's promotional efforts. Quote from Sarah, "You better breastfeed your baby." "Yeah, you better, because the price of milk is so high right now." That caused outrage among the kinds of people who enjoy being outraged. Michelle Bachmann joined in, and pretty soon there was a food fight going on. Or a milk fight, or a... Well, never mind. Anyway, here's a recommendation for the First Lady. An ice cream parlour in central London is serving up breast milk ice cream at $23 a portion starting this weekend. Quote from one of the suppliers, "What could be more natural than fresh, free-range mother's milk in an ice cream?" So, this is free-range mother's milk. None of that inferior stuff you get from battery-farmed mothers. I've always thought it was cruel, keeping them penned up in cages like that while they lactate. So, there you are, Michelle. Ice cream made from free-range breast milk at the Ice Creamists restaurant there in Covent Garden, next to the Opera House. But no, sorry, they don't serve ribs with it. There you have it, listeners. We have Tony Rezko at an undisclosed location in Wisconsin. Wisconsin legislators at undisclosed locations in Illinois. And Illinois residents all rejoicing at the election of Rahm Emanuel as mayor of Chicago, confident that now, at last, the Windy City will have clean, competent, respectful government. Altogether, a bracing week in the nation's affairs. And to top it off, we have the Oscars coming up on Sunday. I naturally have hopes that my own venture into independent movie making will win some recognition. So look out for a mention of Mandy, Candy and Brandy Do Ashgabat, financed by our good friends over there in Turkmenistan. My media empire grows and flourishes. Rupert Murdoch, check your rear view mirror.